inspire it well.
Did you say you were going to go over like a exam hypothetical about the small craft today? Or were we talking about
only that Kinsman Transit was a kind of, you know, hypothetical. And then I also talked about previous exam questions. So those would have been the ones I had in mind.
I still don't really understand. When you were talking about the example today with the ambulance, using all graphs for instead of, you know,
Now, let me turn the question around. What to you would be the significant difference between making a superseding cause argument as distinguished from a Paul's graph argument? Why do you think one would apply more so than the other? Both involve problems of foreseeability, obviously.
Right.
But there's a difference. What's the key thing about a superseding cause argument? Why?
Okay, so you, the people see causes both of the person receiving all
the idea of the superseding cause is that there is somebody, typically a kind of criminal act, or, you know, you've got an intentional act of some kind, or a wrong of pretty significant magnitude, such that in effect, it makes it difficult for the plaintiff to look past this person to blame the one who supplied the bad guy with, you know, the hunting rifle or with the, you know, left the keys in the car or whatever. So the successful superseding cause argument essentially says you can't look behind this big, you know, boulder to find this little pebble and blame everything on the pebble to say that approximately caused the injury. And there are cases where that makes more sense. A Postgraph kind of argument is not so much there's this big boulder and that's the superseding cause. I'll use the definite article there because we really are saying, in effect, that's what caused this thing. The guy shot his girlfriend. You know, it wasn't a hunting rifle that, you know, woke up one day and walked out of the Kmart store and, you know, it was, he did it. The guy murdered his wife. Come on. You know, what are you thinking to try to say that something else caused this? Whereas in a Paul's graph kind of argument, you don't have one of those, you know, sort of large single events or purposeful conduct that you can point your finger at. It's a series of little things. The boat pulls loose of its moorings, it bounces off of here, it gets wedged in there, someone else doesn't come to the bridge. So there are a bunch of little things, and it's not so much that I can point to one of these things and say, see, superseding cause, but the defendant is going to invite the judge or the jury to say, in effect, don't you at some point run out of, you know, doesn't this at some point become so far removed that you can't say that event way back then proximately caused this ultimate result? Now, again, that's one of the key things you want to do as you look at the facts of the situation. What are we talking about in terms of the relationship between the defendant and the plaintiff? Is the defendant's best argument, for example, one of the... I'd be worried about running out of cases, except there are so many exams out there, you will have plenty of others to work from. But one of the hypothetical, or one of the fact patterns I had involved it was someplace, I think they were having a Mardi Gras party. It was a cafe or a bar or something like that. And they had various internal rules about how to manage this, and they had, you know, certain areas where they had a beer garden and they did this other stuff. And one of the patrons wound up getting intoxicated, and I forget exactly what the details were, but eventually he wound up picking up a pool cue. There was billiards going on playing pool, and he picks up a pool cue and whacks the plaintiff. Yeah. What's your best argument from the defendant's standpoint? You're the defendant, that is the tavern, the cafe that's serving alcohol. Yeah. Superseding cause or false ground? Superseding cause, yeah, because you have a guy. I mean, it's not, gee, this strange series of events. I serve this guy alcohol, and then, you know, he picks up a pool cue and whacks somebody. From a false grab perspective, that's very foreseeable. I don't have a good false grab argument there, but I got a pretty good superseding cause argument. If he gets in his car and drives down the highway and runs over somebody, you know, I can't offer any argument on my liability for over-serving him if indeed he was visibly intoxicated and all the rest. If I'm negligent, certainly but am I liable for over-serving him when he then whacks somebody over the head with a pool cue? That's a tougher connection for the plaintiff to make, and that's where, if I were the defendant, I would say, we got him liquored up, but when he chose to whack somebody over the head with a pool cue, that was a superseding cause that broke the chain of causation. And of course, the plaintiff's going to argue the reverse, but at least we've got, you know, we know what argument we're dealing with there. By contrast, in the ambulance case, it's not so much that you've got this, you know, terrible criminal act. You've got a guy who doesn't tie on his spare tire. You've got an ambulance that's not using all the bells and whistles to warn people. You've got another driver who's maybe not paying attention to what he sees in the road and swerves at the last minute. None of those guys, you could say, is a superseding cause, but taken together, particularly where the plaintiff's removed in time and space, you've got a potential false graph argument. So being able to identify it and say, I don't know how you'd resolve this, and you may say to yourself, I don't think the false graph argument is very good, but I would bet that the defendant's going to throw it out there, and this is what I'd say about the false graph argument. Or the defendant's going to make a superseding cause argument. I don't think that's going to work, or whatever. You may feel pretty strongly that you know the answer to the issue, how a court would rule once the issue is raised. But if you raise the right issues and say, gee, if I were the plaintiff, I'd argue this. If I were the defendant, I'd argue that. And in fact, that shows up in my sample answer in my checklist as things I thought were worth discussing, were there. What I'm trying to avoid is having people either see Paul's graph everywhere. You stop at a red light, you know, and you fail to stop at a red light and you hit somebody. Oh, Paul's, you know, most cases don't go there, but I also want to make sure that when it is there, you're able to say, hey, I'd throw the foreseeability issue. And again, they're confusing because both of them use the factor of foreseeability as part of our way of connecting the dots between the defendant's negligence and the plaintiff's injury, to the extent that from the defendant's standpoint, this is a foreseeable kind of consequence, then it makes all sorts of policy sense. This is the normative, evaluative part of the process where we say it's a good and right thing that such defendants are being held liable, even though this wasn't necessarily the first thing you would have thought of. But there's enough of a connection here that, yes, defendants who cause this kind of injury should be forced to pay compensation for it. And so, again, whether the problem is this big, huge, superseding cause in the middle that the plaintiff's having a tough time staring, you know, getting us to look behind, or whether it's this series of fortuitous occurrences, in both cases, again, foreseeability is a question about how close is the relationship here between defendant's negligence and the plaintiff's injury. other questions. Yeah. They might, but they'd be subject to the same, you know, you can only stay to serve a civil procedure question. When you're trying to bring in another defendant or a third-party defendant, you're limited by showing that that third-party defendant owed a duty to the plaintiff, or else owed a duty to you, one or the other, but particularly if you're trying to bring them in Washington, you might try to bring in other defendants by way of allocating fault to someone else. So you say, okay, even if I'm, as the defendant, found to be negligent, I'm only 30% liable for this because this other guy over here is 60% liable and the plaintiff's 10% liable. I can bring in that third party if I can show that indeed they are part of the reason why the plaintiff got injured. That's fair game. But it's still, the burden is on me to show, in fact, they are responsible. They would be a proper defendant in the case. You mean the judge thinks that the connection between the plaintiff and the defendant is just too tenuous? Can who? Can the plaintiff? Yeah, there may be people further back in the chain of causation. And again, typically the plaintiff is pretty aggressive in terms of looking. Plaintiffs are typically not shy about identifying people even at the margin. It's not like they say, well, I've got this guy and that's good enough. Plaintiffs typically say, if I've got a plausible theory, not a lead pipe cinch by any stretch, but somebody who's in the ballpark, I think I can survive a motion for summary judgment, or maybe I can survive. You still include that person with Rule 11 in the back of your head. You know, I don't want to get whacked for Rule 11 or that sort of thing, but if I can survive a Rule 11 challenge and make this person worried about the potential for liability, that's a good thing. And I'm at least going to keep them as a potential defendant, because oftentimes such defendants will throw money at the plaintiff and say, I don't want to go to 16 depositions and sit around and wait and file a summary judgment motion. Maybe I get out, maybe I don't. He'll take $30,000 and release my client. I'll get out of your hair. You'll have $30,000 in your pocket, and we'll all live happily ever after. So typically, plaintiffs err on the side of inclusiveness in terms of naming potential defendants. That's just sort of a strategic. And then you have to evaluate, okay, if the plaintiff thought about naming this defendant, what are the chances they could go there? Just, or flip it the other way, from the defendant's standpoint, that's why I had that case involving the convenience store selling cigarettes. If they get sued, or if somebody's making noises that they want to sue the convenience store, what liability do we face? Could somebody hold us responsible for the damage these kids caused when they were trying to smoke the cigarettes that I sold to them? Would that fly? Is there a legal theory to support that? And the trial court thought there was. So for a while, the defendant had to, you know, treat this as a real problem, and then the appeals court said, no, that's not going to work. So if your instinct, your gut instinct, when you first look at the facts and say, oh, I don't think that's going to work, you may ultimately be right, but again, the reason it makes a good law school exercise is because you have to go through the process to explain your reasoning, how you get there, and to imagine, if I were the plaintiff, what argument would I make? And could I at least get it to the point where a trial judge might leave the convenience store in as a defendant. Because again, that's the stuff of which, you know, settlements get made that might make the difference between at least paying my expenses on this case as opposed to going in the hole by $20,000. That's kind of the way. So I'm trying to think where, well, I think we talked a little bit about the, you know, the recent a homicide trial, the guy who's going 80 miles an hour and kill somebody at Mission, or what was it, Monroe and Francis. You know, the State Patrol was, they were at least talking about the State Patrol as a defendant in the civil case, because the State Patrol allegedly was chasing this guy. So they claimed that the State Patrol was responsible for his traveling at such a high rate of speed and causing a fatal collision. Is their claim against the State Patrol a good one? I don't think so. But again, it just shows you the way in which you err on the side of caution, of inclusiveness, rather than having a very high standard. Oh, we only, you know, sue people where we have a very blue chip kind of case. Doesn't defendants often find themselves getting sued on what they think are pretty marginal, ridiculous grounds, but hey, no one wants to be a defendant in those cases, and it often gives the plaintiff leverage to get a favorable deal. Yeah?
When we apply the false draft test, you mentioned in the past, certain jurisdictions, either use Andrews,
there are some things that are specified on the exam. I'm assuming we'll get through the wrongful death material before the semester is over. And assuming we do that, the way I handle that on the exam is that I give you a statute. I say, you're in the state of Linden, the state of Linden has this statute. And I pull one essentially. I sometimes refer to it as my Ouija board. I make up, you know, I take five digits and make that into a zip code, and whatever that zip code is, if that's in Arkansas or in Ohio or wherever it is, I pull the statute, the wrongful death statute, from that jurisdiction, and that's the one you're asked to deal with. So that part of it will be specified, and as we'll see in wrongful death, it's all statute driven. We don't have these sorts of general principles which courts then try to harmonize, or, you know, they take their marching orders from the legislature for reasons that we'll talk about when we get there. But other than wrongful death, for purposes of this semester, all the other questions where there are jurisdictional variations, you simply have to kind of think about, or, you know, speculate, basically. So, for example, loss of a chance, some jurisdictions will be more liberal in their application of loss of a chance, some will be more restrictive. And so the question for you would be, in effect, does it make any difference? You know, if I were in a jurisdiction that was more liberal about loss of a chance, would that give some advantage to the plaintiff that otherwise the plaintiff would miss out on? If so, then I would essentially put that on my list of things to do. I need to go find out what the rule on loss of a chance is in this jurisdiction, because it might improve the chances that the plaintiff can recover here. On the other hand, if it makes no difference, this isn't a loss of a chance case, or no matter what the loss of a chance theory is, it doesn't really matter in terms of the likelihood that the court's going to permit it, then I don't need to talk about that. Similarly, negligence per se, some jurisdictions are like Carrozza and so on. So, as with the Paul's graph kind of thing as well, you have to essentially say, but for purposes of most exams, giving me the full symphonic version of Cardozo and Andrews, typically doesn't really get your client very far. Because what you have to say in the end is, if I've correctly identified this as a false graft issue, then I essentially say it's going to be a judgment call as to whether the duty of care is extended or whether they consider this a proximate cause. And depending on the outcome of that judgment call, either the plaintiff will be thrown out on summary judgment or will be allowed to pursue this case to potential judgment. So, again, the classic false graft situation is, like false graft, I've got a very strong negligence claim locally, but this remote person over here has got a tougher connecting job to do. And if I correctly identify that and say, in effect, this is a false graft problem, without boring you with all the details about how that case goes, suffice it to say that whether or not this plaintiff will be able to recover will depend upon how liberal or stingy the jurisdiction is in interpreting its standard for the extension of liability. Now, if you want to, you know, go through and say one theory generated by Justice Cardozo was that liability only extends to those people who were in the zone of danger, who were thus owed a duty of care, and as to whom we could say that the defendant was negligent. By contrast, people outside the zone of danger are owed no duty and therefore liable. The second theory accredited Justice, blah, blah, blah. You know, I could, again, most people, by the time we've spent as much time as we have, they're quite comfortable in explaining the legal doctrine. What they have trouble with is figuring out where it applies. When do I, again, this is my sort of my plumbing service analogy. I pull up to the house with my truck full of tools, and I got to figure out, okay, you know, is this the one where I need my radial arm saw or my, you know, whatever it is, or is this one where I say, no, that's not going to do me any good. I might as well leave that one truck. It's got nothing to offer me in terms of solving the problems that are on this particular job site. So some people spend all their energy, you know, in effect, laying out this truck with all the greatest, you know, latest model tools, and they've got them all oiled up and they're all ready to go. But what they really need to spend time doing is getting really good at walking through the house and saying, I can fix that, you know, and here's the tool that I need for that, and here's the other problem I get. And in getting good at identifying the problem, this is why, you know, this sort of issue spotting is the name of the game, rather than how encyclopedic is my knowledge of all these doctrines. And I can tell you every case and every footnote and every opinion and every, you know, whatever it is. But unless I'm good at applying it, I'm not going to perform very well on the exam. So the two work together in that the more you know the doctrines, the better able you are to spot them in a particular case. It's like having an encyclopedic knowledge of literature, and you read something and say, oh, this is the Dostoevsky thing. Ah, this is, you know, whoever. This is a theme from Faulkner, you know, or if you've got that, you can see all the connections and you can comment on it. But so similarly, if you know all this stuff really, really well, in theory, as you read the fact pattern, all these light bulbs start going off, and the little popcorn starts to pop, and oh, there's a negligence per se issue, and there's a res ipsa thing, and that's strict liability, and so forth. But again, I feel like I'm a broken record here. But you can get too much in that mode of, you know, when what you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, so that you're just kind of forcing things onto the situation. At the least little provocation, you're off and running with something without seriously looking at, does this really fit? And again, as I've said before, where you're not even sure, say, well, maybe it fits and maybe it doesn't, instead of sitting there with your pen poised in the air, your fingers hovering above the keyboard, wondering to yourself, should I not, share with me that thinking process to say, well, I'm sort of inclined to argue this, but the problem with arguing this is there's this discrepancy in the facts and doesn't seem to really fit, and therefore I would be disinclined to do it. Or I wouldn't be inclined to do this, but on the other hand, maybe somebody would argue this, and therefore we'd have to address that issue, but I still don't think it's a very good argument. That version of thinking out loud, again, where you're trying to figure out whether the issue fits my facts, that's good stuff. That is the process of issue spotting, because whether the issue is triggered is sometimes by itself an open question. I'm just not sure whether this is worth talking about, you say to yourself. And that indeed is exactly where I am too. You know, I would say there's a pretty bizarre idea here. I don't think it would apply, but as it turns out, a number of students thought it was there and they addressed it, so here's what I think about it. Then, you know, the thinking process represented by the students may show up in the trial judge. Or maybe the opposing lawyer is going to bring this up, even though I think it's a stupid argument, but I'd rather address it and be prepared for it than to say, oh, that's a stupid argument. Nobody would raise that. When, in fact, it does show up. So, yeah, those are sort of the strategic considerations of how to navigate your way through the fact that. More questions? Good.
Social horse liability.
Mm-hmm.
Would it make any difference when you're trying to distinguish them between the commercial provider? Would it make any difference if they were actually social host was selling alcohol?
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, they could almost move to a commercial.
They could easily become a commercial host. Remember, a commercial host is not just somebody who's actually, you know, Moe's Tavern or whatever, or a convenience store. A commercial host for those purposes would be the SBA hosting a, you know, what we used to call a pit party. There used to be in the old building, there was a sort of sunken pit where that was where all the parties happened, and they'd buy a keg of beer and people would drink it. So again, like a banquet, that was Dickinson versus Edwards. It was, you know, they were a commercial host only in the sense that it was a business serving alcohol to their employees at this company banquet. It was commercial in that sense, even though the alcohol wasn't sold. Even more so would it be plausible that although it's a social event, you know, a bunch of students get together and want to go over to Seattle and watch the, whatever it is, the shootout in Seattle or the, whatever that, anyway, Gonzaga basketball team's early games, I think is over in Seattle. So there are a bunch of people who go over there, and then somebody, you know, decides, well, let's have a keg of beer, or let's have, you know, a bar or something, but let's charge people $2 or whatever for a drink. Nominally social, that is, nobody's in the business of doing this, but it has commercial attributes, and then you'd start to ask the question, well, gee, if this is a commercial operation, in the same way that the employer in Dickinson was a commercial host, then the rules of commercial host liability apply, and imposition of liability is okay. On the other hand, if despite the fact that, well, everybody chipped in a little bit, people were asked to buy different things, you know, some people brought chips or hors d'oeuvres or whatever, and some other people brought alcohol, and then there were some people who couldn't bring either, so they just threw some cash into the middle. Well, maybe despite the exchange of money, it's still a social occasion. But again, then figuring out the answer to that issue then turns the standard either into one that's favorable to the plaintiff, or it's we're stuck with this social host rule where the plaintiff can't get to the supplier of the alcohol as a policy reason separating injured victim from social host.
I'm just thinking of, for example, the Halloween party.
Okay.
Where the money will actually go towards the scholarship.
So, is this the SBA that's putting on the Halloween party? Keep going. See, I think they've got the same liability as Dickinson versus Edwards. Now, the saving feature of these things, just be still my beating heart here, and I'm worried about the liability, is, again, you're only subject to a standard of reasonable care. And even a tavern, even Moe's Tavern, is not responsible for over-serving somebody unless they have reason to know that they're intoxicated. So and that's often very difficult, particularly in a... But again, the question would be, and it's actually a good question, this part of it is where the public policy makes sense, is something to ask the people who organize the party, what provision are we making to reduce, are we using reasonable care in reducing the likelihood that people are going to overconsume at this party and then be a menace on the highway? And that's something which, even if there were no tort liability, one would hope that responsible people interested in social justice would try to minimize. But all the more so once you realize, gee, we wouldn't look very good if we have this party and people overindulge and there's no control on, you know, there's no effort to identify people who have to drive or, you know, designated drivers or any other restrictions, just an open bar and everybody, you know, and you basically encourage people where you pay some flat fee and then you drink all you want, where you say, gee, that's sort of an invitation to people to feel like they have to overconsume to get their money's worth. Can't we reorganize this in a way that allows people to behave responsibly? And again, so sort of thinking about it from the standpoint, how would this look on the other end if one of the people at this party hurt somebody on the highway and we had supplied the alcohol that impaired them? How would we look? And if the answer is we wouldn't look very good, then again, the theory, this is the tort theory here, is that serves as the engine of encouraging safer behavior. You'll change the way you do things because the tort system's nipping at your heels saying, watch out, we'll get you. And now again, you know, for every sort of success story of the tort system where it's encouraging people in the right direction, you can identify places where the tort system, either because it enjoys, like social host liability, you've got something carved out where somebody's derailed the tort system from its useful function, or you have the tort system that's gone too far, and instead of encouraging people to behave more safely, it's just made everybody miserable. So people are wandering around taking all their diving boards out and, you know, shutting down their public parks because, well, we can't afford the liability if somebody gets hurt. And again, what you know, from kind of a larger macro perspective, you want to begin to think, well, where are the places where the tort system is doing the right thing and we ought to let it do its thing, and what doctrinal anomalies do we have where it's not doing what it's supposed to do, or it's overdoing stuff that it shouldn't be doing? And to the extent that you can tweak it, then it will exert a more salutary influence. Other questions? Did you guys talk about the bar exam and civil procedure? Gary was... No? Gary, yes, as we pass I was going into the 11 o'clock section. And past Jerry, we'd had a little bit of faculty email traffic on the bar exam, so I was curious.
Okay.
Well, that was sort of the gist of the conversation in civil procedure, as I understand it, was the question of whether that's sort of a waste of time. For my exams, I tend to be less interested in the kind of interesting policy debate, for example, on whether strict liability or negligence is a better rule for society. I'm less interested in that because it typically isn't something that will be directly beneficial to your client. And my job, one, in the exam is do a good job for your client. Treat your client the way you want to be treated when you go to the doctor with some health complaint. You want the doctor to help you solve, you know, in my pain, restore me to whatever it is, take away my worries, get me back to being normal again. And so when somebody comes to a lawyer, either because they've been injured and they want compensation, or they're a defendant and they're worried that somebody's going to get compensation from them, as I envision the task, it's primarily give the kind of advice that will tell this person with as much accuracy as you can, here's what you're up against. Here's how I would assess the chances that you can essentially get back to normal. If you're the plaintiff, that you can recover compensation. If you're the defendant, that you can avoid having to be, that you can avoid being forced to pay compensation. So to the extent that policy figures into it, it's it may be, again, the sort of thing, for example, if it's the Kmart hunting rifle case, policy would, we could have a very lively policy debate about whether we would be better off or worse off if gun manufacturers were held responsible for the harm that people cause using firearms. And some people, I'm sure, would take, you know, there, we'd have a range of opinion on that topic, and it's very much an issue of public policy right now. Do you think that gun control is a good thing or a bad thing? I don't think that helps your client particularly, because whether you're right or wrong, whether you have a persuasive argument about gun control or not, the issue for them is, can I get compensation or will I be forced to pay compensation? Now, as it turns out, whether somebody thinks that the guy is a superseding cause, the guy who buys the hunting rifle when he's drunk and goes home and shoots his girlfriend, whether you think that guy's a superseding cause will in turn be a reflection of underlying ideas, policies that they have. So if I were picking a jury and I'm the plaintiff, and I would ask the jurors the question, do you agree with this proposition, guns don't kill people, people kill people? And I found everybody who agreed with that, and I kicked them off the jury. You know, if I'm the plaintiff, I don't want that attitude. Because that kind of attitude is the kind that would say, oh, gun manufacturers or people who sell guns are not responsible, people pull the trigger are responsible. And by contrast, if I got, so yeah, that policy thing does show up, but from the standpoint that you either can or can't make a good argument, there could be law school classes. If I were teaching constitutional law, or if I were teaching this class in a different way, perhaps, I might invite you. And in the past, once upon a time, I used to give exams which would at least occasionally include a small policy question. So, for example, I would say, on wrongful death, you are legislative counsel to Senator Schmo, who's considering a revision of the civil code dealing with the treatment of wrongful death. You know, and Senator Schmo asks you what he or she should do about pain and suffering damages or something. What would you tell Senator Schmo? So I could ask you that, and you would want to say, well, here's the argument for this, and here's the argument against it, and being able to make those policy arguments. I haven't done that in a long time. It's an interesting, you know, and we do spend a lot of time talking about that in class, and that's a little bit sort of misleading, because I do invite you to sort of get into it on that point, and if people have strong opinions about that, that helps to liven things up. But again, it all gets corralled in the exam in the form of, what are you going to tell your client? And to the extent that you may have a great idea for how the railroad ought to be run in a more efficient way, is not the skill I'm looking for right at this moment. I do think the more you're interested in this and you begin to form opinions, or in most cases people already have opinions, and they either have those confirmed or they begin to modify them, or maybe they flip over and take an opposite tack, those things, again, I think make the course more lively and help you remember how the discussion went and why courts do this and why they don't do that. But I'm not really interested, at least for testing purposes, in your ability to make me a good policy argument. Part of the difficulty for me is I have a tough time grading those things. I mean, I can look at whether you have a shopping list of arguments for and arguments against, but I don't know, I just sort of lost my taste for it after a while. And now all I want to see is can you be a good, you know, defense lawyer, a good plaintiff's lawyer, and it seems to me that's first of all pretty difficult to do, and it's a worthy thing to do, you know, whatever your feelings are about the way the law should be, being able to take a plaintiff and tell them, hey, this is what your case looks like, and these are the things that look good for you, and these are the things that look bad for you, or same way for the defendant. It seems to me like you have a useful thing to do as a lawyer if you know how to do that well. And it is very challenging because it requires a lot of judgment and creativity and time management and the ability to kind of weave your way through these difficult fact patterns. So, again, as you go back and look at the past exams, policy will show up sometimes in shading. Maybe this jurisdiction has a policy in this direction, or particularly in legal cause. Again, well, that's a normative evaluator. That is a policy decision, but I'm not, you know, as a lawyer trying to wade into that and change the policy. I'm just trying to predict it. Yeah. I don't think it's too soon now. I mean, I think what I would do is, I mean, I'd consume all, not all, but I'd consume a lot of the so-called the December exams, first semester exam, before I wound up taking it. And I'd do them in sort of ascending order. The first time I would just pull an exam out and spend 10 minutes reading through it and read, you know, another 10 minutes reading through the sample answer just to get an idea of the sorts of issues that come up. You know, think about the question for just a second, get an idea of what I begin to talk about it, and then look at the sample answer and see how close I was. And just do a couple of those just to kind of jumpstart my brain, and as I'm sitting in class, I would keep seeing the way, okay, I see how I could use that in this, and I see how this showed up in a past exam. So it helps to sharpen, I think, the time you spend in class. As you get closer to the exam and you want to do a more and more realistic, you know, if it's a week before class is over, because the last week of class is all review, I give you an outline. And I field questions. It's essentially just like this, only it's with the whole class, and say, you know, ask me questions, let's talk about this. So we stop covering new material a week before class ends. And at that point, sit down with a past exam and give yourself 3 hours and try to do that exam as close to realistic as possible, and then look, did I basically identify the right issues, and did I, you know, how close am I coming to lining up on this? And to the extent that there are discrepancies, then you say, well, you spent all this time talking about this, and I didn't see where that was coming from. Or I spent a whole lot of time talking about this, and you didn't even talk about it. What's, you know, I don't see why you you shouldn't have talked about this other thing. And again, I just think that's, but moving up to that point, with each week that we go by, you can spend more time getting realistic feedback to yourself on how close am I getting to really. I keep picking up these exams, and each time I pick one up, I feel better and better that I could take this thing and run with it. There are a few little things we haven't quite covered yet, still kind of shaky on. But with respect to things that we have covered, you know, I got the abnormally dangerous activity stuff, and the recipient issue, and the negligence per se, and, you know, all that other stuff. I saw it, and what DeWolf said about it didn't surprise me. Those sort of along the same lines that I was thinking. That's where I hope you're, you know, each time you do it, you get more and more confident that whatever he throws at me on the exam, it won't come as a terrible shock, because I've done 5 or 6 of these things, and each time there was a few little wrinkles, but for the most part I felt we were on the same wavelength. And that to me is, again, when you have whatever it is, 20 exams out there, that I can burn a couple of them. I've already burned a couple because I've talked about them. But you can burn a couple more and still have plenty left over to do a full dress rehearsal. And I just think any time you can do that sort of dress rehearsal for whatever class it is, whatever assignment it is, the closer you get to a full dress rehearsal, just the more confident you are. You wind up walking into the exam, and instead of having it just this cloud of anxiety descend upon you, it feels more like something you've done before. And you can devote more of your attention to the thinking and problem solving as opposed to using that precious attention to think, can I still get my student loan money if I, you know, flunk this exam, and could I drop this class? And which we all do, you know, this is, I walk into my first trial and I'm thinking, you know, could I get disbarred if they, you know, I mean, this is the sort of thing that this is human nature that we start, some of us are sicker than others, but it's a very normal thing for people to be to go into disaster mode. And the more you feel as though, well, this isn't a disaster. I've done one of these things before. I did better than some, worse on others, but I know how to do this. Then you're less likely to waste that mental energy and just emotional energy. You wind up, 3 hours is a long time, too, for the exam, and it's very easy to just get physically exhausted and emotionally exhausted. And then you can't, you know, if you're like me, you can't sleep very well the night before. So you wake up in the middle of the night before the exam. So all that kind of stuff, you can't completely make it go away, but the more you've done a full dress rehearsal, I think the more hours of sleep you're going to get the night before, the more you'll walk into the exam. And then, of course, substantively, too, you'll have had a chance to see, oh, gee, I completely missed the market share liability theory on that, or I misread the facts. You know, I was doing great. I had no trouble with the legal doctrine, but I just skipped over this thing in the facts. And I realized upon rereading, when I read the sample answers, so different, I then reread the fact, and oops, you know, I jumped a couple of switches there, and I just didn't read it carefully. So debugging that part of your preparation, just, I think it just makes a huge difference in how well you do this. And I must say that in part, consciously or not, whether, I don't know whether this is done consciously or not, but the fact is that law school is a testing process not just of this intellectual capacity, but it's a testing process of your ability to take on a big challenge and respond to it in an appropriate way. So, you know, a lot of these things really don't have to do with your substantive knowledge. They just have to do with, when you have a challenge like this, do you do things like, you know, go back and look for past exams? Do you practice with them? Do you prepare for them? Do you try to test yourself for them? Do you do the kinds of things that are going to put you in the best shape to do it? And if you do, you will outperform people who are really, you know, smarter than you are, who even maybe worked harder but weren't as smart about how they prepared for it. So, you know, and to the extent that law school winds up favoring people who are kind of cunning in that way, whether it should or it shouldn't, it does. And to that extent, it just says, okay, let me think about this from the standpoint. I mean, I was terribly naive when I took my first law school exams. I'm not sure I ever got particularly good at it, because I was still sort of living in this world, an academic world, of thinking it was about knowledge and about, you know, policy questions. And I paid close attention to all these exciting policy questions, and then I pick up the exam, it's got nothing to do with that, you know. And I would say, you know, what was I thinking? And at the same time, I realized it would have behooved me to pay closer attention to, well, how does this professor define success? Now, I did have, I must say, I had other standards for my legal education than simply doing well in the exams. I didn't care that much about grades. I probably should have. But I had other things I cared more about, and so the fact that, other people were more cunning about that, I figured, well, so be it. I'm getting what I want out of this legal education. But again, to the extent that performing well in terms of getting a good grade is important to you, then I think it's, you know, reduce it in that, be a reductionist. And I don't think there's any shame in that. I do think you ought to have, as I think I did, other goals besides doing well, but to the extent that you say, okay, I want to get a good GPA, then be cunning about figuring out, well, you know, what do I know about the way this professor gives exams? What's the format of the exam? Can I practice the format of the exam? Do I have a sense of the style that this professor expects? And so forth and so on. And some of us have a longer paper trail and are easier to scope out, and others have a shorter paper trail and more difficult to scope out. But I just think doing that is a... You know, I don't consider that to be unethical, or that, you know, you're high-minded if you don't think about these things. Law school really is, in many ways, preparing you for the kind of practice where you're going to be a successful lawyer. You figure out how to pick a good jury, you know, so that instead of making the most high-minded argument to those people who are enthusiasts for the Brady Bill, but I will, through the powers of my persuasion, explain to them why the Brady Bill, you know, is a bad way to look at this problem. I want to do some of that for the jurors I'm stuck with, but to the extent I can get a set of jurors that are closer already to thinking what I want them to think, that's probably going to be my approach. And at least recognizing that's what's going on. Whereas if I spent all my time with my client coming up with the most persuasive, compelling argument for my version of the public policy, but I didn't pay any attention to who wound up sitting on the jury, I wouldn't be doing my client a service, I don't think. So at least identifying, okay, these are the levers that get pushed. You do, obviously, you know, there does come a point of ethical behavior where you say, that might be very effective, you know, bribing some of the jurors, you know, sending the judge a case of scotch. I mean, there are things I could do that might influence the process, but I'm not going there. But short of that, I think figuring out which kinds of anyway, that's not how I got sure.
You know, in chapter one we kind of talked about the tools to establish the law of the chapter two. Do these is it the same not policy but the same kind of procedure? We're looking at the proximate cause and these different tools and selecting.
Well, the difference
or is one specific proximate cause.
In chapter one I'm essentially comparing a bunch of parallel any port in a storm kind of, you know, if a racist locator argument is going to get me where I want to go, I can ride that horse, so to speak, and forget everything else. Whereas in the proximate cause section, I have two tests. I've got to show that it's but for cause, so, you know, I have to evaluate how strong my case is with respect to that, if I'm the plaintiff or if I'm the defendant, what roadblocks I can put up to avoid a finding of but for causation. And at the same time, I'm going to be looking at the legal cause. You know, do I have any legal cause problems that I need to address? Are there superseding cause problems? Are there false grab problems? Are there, you know, mere chance kinds of problems? And in that respect, legal cause winds up being a sort of a negative thing from a plaintiff's standpoint. Instead of making a positive case, it's in a way sort of bracing myself to see, am I facing any problems? Whereas in chapter one, it's more of a kind of, how do I make my positive case with respect to legal cause? The plaintiff's sort of saying, do I see any problems here? And there are lots of cases where there really are no legal cause arguments. You got an intersection collision, you know, a guy who's running a red light. Assuming I can establish negligence, gee, the causation issues are non-existent. It's all about chapter one. Or it may be just the other way around. I've got a clear case where there's negligence. That's the easy part of it. It's all the chapter two stuff of what's the connection. I've got terrible but-for cause problems. I've got terrible legal cause problems. Negligence, sure, but what's the connection? So, again, that's where I think looking at these exams even to just sort of make sure that I can do a quick inventory. Bing, bing, bing. Here are the negligence or strict liability issues that I see raised. Here are what I think are the proximate cause issues. Am I right about that? Did I correctly assess those? And then we'll start in with chapter three and the issue about damages. You know, where am I going with that?